Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Joel Fox, editor of the Fox and Hounds website, author and journalist Joe Matthews, and Constance Rice, noted civil rights activist and attorney with the Advancement Project. Our program tonight coming to you from our studios at the Westwood One Studios in Culver City, California, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv, and you can tweet us questions at BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont. And again, we're here in California for the next several weeks. And again, full 2 hours this evening talking about what's transpiring in this state as it relates to national politics. And obviously, the big story since we last met was what has been described as Bridgegate involving Chris Christie and whether or not that is a significant detour on his alleged road to the White House. And I want to get reaction from everyone. And we'll start with you, Joe Matthews, as a journalist and as an author who's covered politics in this state for a long, long time and observes politics from afar as well. How badly do you think Chris Christie has been hurt because of the revelations of this past week and also the way he has responded to it thus far?
Badly by the revelations, even more badly by the way he's responded to it thus far. I covered Arnold Schwarzenegger and wrote a book about him. Governor Schwarzenegger was a person who often had a lot to apologize for, and he became quite good at it. And fundamental to the sort of apology is owning it, to leaving no room for more inquiries, nowhere for critics to go. Christie sort of didn't play that. He apologized in a narrow way that he didn't know. He tried to put separation between people who work for him and himself, a big mistake. When your staff, particularly key staff.
Well, what should he have done, though?
I mean, he should have said,
I knew about it. If he didn't know about it.
No, I would have said something. He should have said something like he would have ended it by saying something along the lines of, I didn't know, but it doesn't matter that I didn't know. It's just the same as if I were laying the cones out on the George Washington Bridge myself. These are people I knew who I worked for. It's as if I did it myself in full knowledge. And you're not going to believe me anyway. I'm a politician. This is entirely my fault. There should have been no attempt to deflect blame. And it'll keep up inquiry, endless inquiry now to try to tie him. What did he know? When did he know it? And he really sort of kept the thing spinning forward and really blew it, I thought.
Joel Fox, Fox and Hounds, you've been covering politics for a few years.
Been involved in it for many years. Yeah. I don't have the same outlook as Joe does on this. First of all, if in fact more investigation reveals that Christie did know about it, then I think he's toast.
Right.
So I really do think it's a serious matter of government abuse. There's, just as much as I would rail against the IRS looking at certain political groups, I would rail against Governor Christie if he knew that he was causing that
problem. Were you surprised that he was emphatic? Because he was emphatic that he didn't know anything about it.
Well,
because, if something comes out now, I agree with you.
Well, right. Certainly if in fact something comes out now and he was so emphatic, he's hanging himself.
Right.
So the hope is that he really didn't know about it. For his future career. And as far as how he responded to it, I'm not as harsh as Joe is on that comment. I think that I thought he did as well as he could under the circumstances. He certainly did say it was his fault, but how could he say, this is the end of it? You can't say that because there's going to be investigations. The man is considered one of the prime candidates for president of the United States. He's a political character with a political opposition. They're not going to end it if he says it the way that Joe said he should say it.
Constance Rice, you've seen politicians squirm quite a bit in your career as an observer. Your reaction to is this a devastating, serious blow against Christie?
Too early to tell. I can't tell right now whether it's really devastating. It's going to depend on what comes out. We don't know a lot.
How has he handled it so far? That two-hour press conference, that was pretty significant?
It was significant. What I found startling about it was how narcissistic it was. I like Christie. I really do like him. But that performance that he did, while it was, I'm humiliated, I'm very sad, I'm devastated by this, I'm firing my closest people, it was all about him. He didn't reference the suffering of the Fort Lee folks at all. And I just found it really narcissistic. It was all about him. They violated my trust. I'm sad. I'm hurt. I'm humiliated. It was pretty stunning. Although, on the other hand, you know, the other pundits who are talking about how he made a clean breast of it and he really took it and he owned it and so forth, I don't think that's wrong. What I think was missing was that, number one, he didn't personalize it, and he didn't empathize at all. Number two, it was all self-absorbed.
He eventually went to apologize to the mayor of Fort Lee.
Who didn't want to hear from him.
Who didn't really want to hear from him.
Yeah,
but,
he
but
had
again,
a good
he was,
outing.
He was aggressive.
He had a good outing, and I think a number of PR experts were saying that he did the right thing here.
When you throw two key people under the bus, those people are not going to keep their mouths shut forever, are they, Joe? I mean, are they the next shoes to fall? Because if they feel that they're bearing the brunt of this, aren't they going to get even in some way?
No, I think their incentives are to shut up if they want to work in politics again. To make this go away, to not talk about it.
What about if they want to be a commentator on MSNBC?
Well, then they might go a different direction. But if they want to work again, going away for a while, being quiet about it, not turning on the boss is the path to a comeback in their chosen career.
Do you think Christie is a serious challenger for the Republican nomination, really? Or is this just a New York, Washington, D.C. beltway belief that this guy, the New Jersey governor, is going to play in the Midwest?
He's a very compelling media character. I'm a California independent, and I'm not sure I inhabit mentally the same country as American Republicans do. It's a hard thing to understand, harder and harder for me to understand what the heck it is that they are thinking and how they see the world. To me, Christie, someone who could win a state like New Jersey, is a compelling figure, despite this problem, is someone who interests me.
He's got to win in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina Joel.
Yeah, but he's a viable candidate who could get a lot of the establishment behind him. And even if he gets bumped off in Iowa, we know many candidates who have done that and who come back and won in New Hampshire and won in some of the other states. He's obviously in the media spotlight, which gives him an advantage. He has won in a heavily Democratic state, which makes him a viable candidate. And he appeals to some of the folks who may not like him that much, but when he stands up against the teachers union and things like that, they'll say, well, maybe we'll give him a shot. So I think he's a viable candidate.
I want to get reaction. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight from Culver City, I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City, and let's go to calls. Let's go to Mike listening to us in Fresno. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hello, Mike. Go ahead.
Very good show. Yeah, very good show.
Thank you.
It's amazing to me that they say that this Christie guy, I'm not a Christie guy, but he's toast if he's guilty. He's out for the presidency. But Clinton is still in, and four guys are dead. They haven't done nothing about Benghazi. Our government, they've done nothing about Fast and Furious. They appointed a federal investigator the next day on Christie. You can't even get a pizza delivered that quick. I mean, this is beyond description. I want one of your guests, I think Joe started this thing off, explain to me why somebody being held up on the freeway is more important than four people dead.
Joe, I want to get Joe's going to respond, and then I'm going to offer my two cents in this. Joe?
It's an interesting point you make. You know that accountability isn't what it used to be. Speed of speed of media, speed of things, our diminished expectations of politicians. You know, who knows? You may be right. We may have all forgotten about this. I tend to think that the problem with how Christie handled this is he's sort of keeps open the lines of inquiry, sort of produce more questions than answers, and that's why the thing keeps going. I mean, I would argue that the way that the administration handled the Benghazi thing, was fairly similar, and that's not actually going away either.
But it's also a world away. And not to put down the fact, I mean, it's very important to find out what happened there, and that four people were killed is very serious and obviously something that we should all be concerned about.
Hillary says, who cares?
But I'm sorry?
Hillary says, who cares?
Well,
that's
not
what she said.
But the Christie thing affected a lot of people in the media capital of the world, and they're on top of it because it even affected them. And I think that's why it's blown up so quickly. But to the gentleman's point, Benghazi hasn't gone away. It's still part of the discussion that we have and will be part of the discussion if, in fact, Bruce, as you point out, Hillary runs for president.
Connie.
But the reason there's a different reaction to it is because it's pineapples and zebras. Benghazi is about the fact that we shouldn't have an embassy in zones we can't defend Americans. And that's a policy decision that spans both parties' administrations, number one. Number two, yeah, there was malfeasance and there was a mistake and people shouldn't have died, but my argument is that we shouldn't have had an embassy there at all. That's a completely different issue from whether somebody abused their power, got an enemies list, and punished hundreds of thousands of people and endangered them over a political vendetta in a race where he won by over 20 percentage points. I mean, it really is zebras and pineapples. And I hope the listeners can get out of that. I know it's easy to do. You get into this kind of, well, they got their way and we didn't get our way. Get out of the polarized sets of points here and just really look at them for what they are.
Mike, also, one other thing which I think is the difference. I mean, you've heard me say in this program, I think Benghazi is an important issue. Granted, there is political fodder for the Republicans to push it, but I think we should want to know what really happened there. That's my personal belief. But insofar as a scandal and why one scandal moves forward or one scandal, a scandal for it to be politically effective has, in my view, has got to be something that can go on a bumper sticker that the average American can understand and comprehend. There's all kinds of variations of the Benghazi story that are open to interpretation. When you're stuck in traffic trying to go to work, everybody can relate to that. Everybody can relate to that. And again, if the opposition to Chris Christie can make the particular point that somehow he ordered this or was aware of it, which he has emphatically said he was not aware of it, then he will be in trouble. But what I think happened, and I want to get everybody's reaction to this because you've all been involved in political campaigns. When you work for the king, whether the king is the president or the governor or the king, people surrounding the king, they pretty much know what the king wants, and they're always trying to impress the king, even though the king may not ask them to specifically do them. And it's been referred to as the culture. I mean, people were saying it was the Obama culture that led to these aggressive people in the IRS in Cincinnati because they thought or they believed the president really wanted them to do this and go after right-wing groups. Would you acknowledge that in political campaigns, those are the people who become the chiefs of staff? They become the people that have been thrown under the bus. They wanted to impress Chris Christie, and maybe they used their influence, they got caught in doing it.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. I mean, as long as if we're assuming in your question, Bruce, that Christie didn't know, right?
Right.
And you're saying, well, they want to impress him because they thought he might want to do that. As long as he didn't order it and it's not something he wanted to do, I think in the end it doesn't matter.
Okay. Jim in Chicago listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good evening. This is, like the previous gentleman said, you know, this is just really an overreaction, hyper-focus of the media, where they wholly under-focused for the previous mentioned Benghazi gate, NSA gate, IRS gate. Let's go back to the beginning of Obama when they, you know, hijacked the car companies and took all these innocent. I had two friends that lost their car dealerships back when they took over GM and Chrysler. You know, there's been all these scandals and all this thuggery of the Obama administration, and the media has been silent.
Well, maybe that's because the examples that you're citing are really policy decisions. You may think of them as thuggery, but it takes a pretty paranoid perspective to come up with that, don't you think?
Jim?
Yes?
You reacting to that?
Well, you know, it's a lot of the stuff is illegal. I mean, a lot of the stuff, in my opinion, is impeachable stuff. I mean, sending guns to Mexico, for example, and have them, you know, kill our border guard guy is not just a policy decision.
Well, if we're going to start, you know, if we're going to start impeaching people for sending guns to Mexico, then there are millions of people and no shortage of people who sell guns in this country who need to be impeached. You know, that's a tough one, and the notion of the auto bailouts being thrown in to, you know, those were big steps, and they look like pretty good ones to me from the perspective of 2014.
Jim, listen, thanks very much for your call. You know, before this Bridgegate story broke in any significant way, last week I went to see American Hustle. Mm-hmm. And as I was watching American Hustle, if you've not seen it, it's about corrupt New Jersey politics and everything else. And as I'm watching that movie, I'm saying, you know what? There's no way in the world this movie is going to help Chris Christie. This reinforces everything bad. And when you throw American Hustle in with The Sopranos, in with Jersey Shore, I, as someone who grew up in the Midwest, I can't believe that anything given the perception of New Jersey is ever going to get elected to anything in this country.
I disagree. I disagree.
Okay.
If you've seen the movie, the most noble character in the movie is the politician,
the mayor.
Played by Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
And he's willing to break a few eggs and play with some
for the good
pretty,
of the people.
From some pretty difficult people and play some difficult games for the good of the people. I actually wish we had – I thought that movie's perspective was refreshing and one that we need more of. This notion that politics can be is a dirty game and that's the way it is and that we should celebrate a little bit of that dirt because if it ends up delivering, you know.
Not in an Iowa caucus, not in a New Hampshire primary, not in a South Carolina primary. Those are the first three things that you've got to survive, and I'm just saying, New Jersey ain't going to help them.
You know, the issue of, the last caller had a litany of things that he thought the administration did. Look, and I don't think that's the discussion here. I think the discussion when you talk about the Bridgegate is abuse of government power.
Exactly.
I think the IRS controversy would be a parallel. But beyond that, I think that's what we're talking about, abusing government power to, in essence, hurt some of the constituents. And I think if, in fact, that's proven to be true, I will stick by my earlier statement that he would be toast. If it's not proven to be true, I think 2 years from now when he goes to Iowa, it will be a backstory, but it won't be a primary story.
And he may not get the nomination, but I don't think it'll be because of this.
No.
I'll tell you, I mean, it's really fascinating to listen to the callers because maybe I need to get out of my bubble a little bit more. But I'm fascinated by the fact that there's an equivalency here that just doesn't fit. I mean, it just doesn't fit. This is about abuse of power, and he hurt innocent people. The usual thing about the corruption in New Jersey and the corruption in Illinois. Not so much Louisiana. Those are our three most corrupt states, I think. Is that they usually hurt players who are political players. This incident was an abuse of power, and it hurt innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different. But you can't equate that with policy decisions that two administrations share, number one. Number two, mistakes are made. The IRS thing, They went after liberal groups, too. You want to know what that's about? That's just the IRS trying to make sure nobody gets a deduction they don't like. They don't like the deductions for political and nonprofit status. So they don't like this definition. It's too loose. It's too loose for liberals and for conservatives, and they're going to rein it in. That's what it's about.
When we come back, we're going to switch gears. We're going to be talking a little bit about California politics. You know, the last week on this program, we talked about, you know, significant political movements start in California and they move east. Good movements and bad movements. We're going to talk about both when we continue. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border tonight live from Culver City, California. From coast to coast and border to border, this is Bruce Dumont every Sunday night on America's great radio stations as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. Before we introduce tonight's guests, let us welcome new listeners tonight on Progressive Talk 1450 KPTR in Palm Springs, California. It's nice to be back on the air in Palm Springs. We've been off for several years there, so if you're listening to us in the beautiful city of Palm Springs, where I spent some time over the last couple of days, it'll be good to hear from you this evening. Progressive Talk 1450 KPTR, and again, our thanks to Steve Kelly for putting us on the air in Palm Springs, and also I enjoyed being a guest on his show this past week. Around the table this week, we have some interesting guests, and we're going to let them introduce themselves right now, and we begin with Joe Matthews. And Joe, I should mention to the audience, you've been a guest on this program a number of times over the years, so it's good to see you face-to-face and playing on your home field in California tonight.
It's good to be warmer. I'm a California editor and write a statewide syndicated column with Zocalo Public Square, which is a nonprofit based here in LA that publishes daily, both on our site and in about 110 publications around the country, including USA Today, Time Magazine, and we put on free live events, about 70 of them a year. So we're a bit tired.
Authored numerous books, one on Arnold Schwarzenegger and one on the fiscal crisis in the state.
Just two, yes, and that may be it for a while.
Connie Rice also joins us. Connie, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thanks, Bruce. I am a recovering civil rights lawyer. I used to litigate a lot. I used to sue the police a lot, and now I find myself being a consultant to police a lot. That's an interesting turn. But I've been privileged to work on reforming LAPD and a number of other police departments. And I've done a number of other cases, bus riders cases and so forth. So I've had a great time trying to make LA a better place. I am an author. I have written a book called Power Concedes Nothing, and it's about my travels through gangland and copland, and it's a great read.
And also, you're with the Advancement Project. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we are a policy and legal change shop. We're social change. We're a social change organization, and it's not your grandmother's civil rights organization, I'll put it that way. We're about taking lawyers and policy analysts and making stuff happen so that folks at the bottom of the ladder can pull themselves out.
Joel Fox.
Well, I've been involved with California politics. I'm originally from Massachusetts, been involved with California politics for over 35 years. I worked with Howard Jarvis, who put on the famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, Proposition 13, California's property tax reform. After he passed away, I was president of his taxpayer group for a dozen years. I've since consulted mostly on measures and ballot measures and policy issues. A couple of candidates worked with Richard Reardon, the former mayor of Los Angeles when he ran for governor, and Arnold Schwarzenegger during the recall campaign. I was one of the first people he hired as a policy advisor. I currently have a blog on California business and politics called foxandhoundsdaily.com, which has been recognized by the Washington Post as one of the top statewide political blogs. And I do some writing myself. I have a 10-year-old book on Proposition 13 called The Legend of Prop 13, but I also have a couple of mystery novels out there. Yeah. I have a FBI hero who solves modern-day mysteries, and they always link to something in back of a history in a dealing with a president. The first one's called Lincoln's Hand, and the catalyst there was the attempt to steal Abraham Lincoln's body, which is true. Second one's called FDR's Treasure, and it's about FDR going down on these fishing expeditions near Cocos Island, where it's supposed to be a treasure island.
Now, when we have talked about California politics in the past, from our home base in Chicago, the popular perception of the state is that it's a basket case for a variety of reasons. First of all, if you're a Republican, the Republican Party is dead here. It's not likely ever to come back, at least based on the conversation we had last week on this program, and that it's a financial basket case. And yet, this past week, a new state budget came out, and at least the initial response was that California is coming back, and you've got a surplus. I mean, what's happening in this state, and what is the relationship between the governing class in this state and the business class and the business community in this state, which Fox and Hounds covers on a regular basis?
Well, it's tepid, to say the least. But when, as you pointed out, the Republican Party is so weak, then the business community looks toward Governor Brown as their last, as their goalie, the backstop to, mm-hmm. to stop any kind of aggressive action from a liberal legislature. There's a supermajority of Democrats in the legislature. They can have their way with spending and tax issues and constitutional amendments. It takes a two-thirds vote to put on the ballot. They have their two-thirds vote. So the question is, what does Governor Brown do? And the business community has turned to him. And the budget you talk about that he released, while there is an increase in spending, he also has talked about paying down the debt in the state and creating a reserve for future problems with the state spending. So the business community is rallying around him. And also part of that formula is there is no particular strong Republican candidate to challenge Governor Brown in this year's election.
Yeah, and that was certainly loud and clear last week that he's unbeatable at this particular moment. Is he a good governor, Connie? Again, you're progressive.
Right.
You're a progressive. I mean, is he doing the progressive things you want him to do, or doesn't he have to do them anymore?
I don't think he has to do them anymore. And no, for me, he's not a good governor because he's in denial about what's really going on in California. California's politics are like its fault lines and its tectonic plates. The real action is beneath the ground. It's in the invisible part of the state. And the thing about LA's politicians and California's politicians is that they act like there are no tectonic plates underneath this land. And we've got nothing but fault lines and tectonic plates. And what by that I mean, we ignore the very poorest people in California, and there are millions of them. We ignore the fact that the ladder of upward mobility is dead. There are no rungs on the ladder. And nobody cares. You can't get Governor Brown to address it. You couldn't get Schwarzenegger to address it. Even the liberals and the progressives, they'll talk about, you know, tax credits for Hollywood before they'll talk about universal daycare or pre-K. The stuff that's needed, because we have a huge immigrant population that if we don't bring up to speed, if we don't get these folks to the first world level, California is a third world state and LA is a third world city. And nobody seems to want to acknowledge that reality.
Joe, other than Los Angeles, what are the other pockets in this state where either there's horrible things happening, this Teutonic involvement that Connie just mentioned, either horrible things happening, or are there pockets of this state where there's some positive things happening?
Well, the Bay Area is surging and doing very well. There are pockets of the Bay Area that are very different. I mean, you can go to Facebook headquarters, and then within, you know, in a 5-minute drive be in East Palo Alto, which is a community with a lot of difficulties. But when you sort of zero up beyond that, you know, inland California is really, really hurting. I mean,
give us some cities that people around the country would know.
You know, the Inland Empire of Southern California, Riverside and San Bernardino County, the communities out in the desert, you know, the east of San Diego, and certainly in the San Joaquin Valley. It's not a perfect picture. You know, Bakersfield and Kern County is doing pretty well. That's an oil-producing area. It's got an economy a little bit like Texas. And even LA is really struggling, and the state as a whole has almost a 2-point higher unemployment rate than the rest of the country. Now that's not a new thing. We've often, for most of our history, had a little bit of a higher unemployment rate than the rest of the country. But often in our past, that was because there were so many people showing up here.
How has this? I want to get reaction from everybody, yeah. Connie, first. How has this this underbelly of the state. How has it changed the culture of what it means to be a California? Is there any sense of community amongst these divergent groups that have come to California?
Well, if you go to some of these communities, for example, you go to Yucaipa County, that's on the very, very
up in the north,
or if you go way down to Yolo County in the very, very southern near Mexico. Mm-hmm.
Yolo's up north.
What's the one on the Imperials, right? Okay, there are counties that are so poor that they're like rural Texas, and they're not a part of any of the California dream that you've heard Joe and Joel talk about. This state is really five different countries. It's a country, and there are five different states in it. And for most Californians, and if you talk about immigrant Californians, poor Californians, you're talking about 30 and 40% unemployment. You're not talking about 7, 10, 12. And for the underclass, for African Americans who haven't had jobs in five generations, you're talking 60% unemployment. And what we've decided to do with those folks is lock them up. So I don't see any capacity or strength or willingness to touch these third rails. And what I see instead is a mass incarceration strategy. We've just locked up entire generations of people. We lock up the mentally ill. We lock up the homeless. And we have a prison industrial complex. You've got entire towns that rely on locking up people in prisons in order to have an economy. Now, that's no economy, and it's no way to treat your citizens who are doing nonviolent crime.
And it's also...
can't afford it.
It's also not unique to California.
Exactly.
Rural legislators, their trade-off in virtually every state, that the many of the prisons are built between the state capital, wherever it is, to their home district.
Exactly.
And the goal is to lock up the poor and underclass, in many cases minorities, who are populating
right.
the large cities. We have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. We've got callers on the line. Got a call from Sacramento coming in, and we will hear from him when we roll on from Culver City. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. From Peabody, Massachusetts to Pomona, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border, tonight live from Culver City, California. Joel, you wanted to make a point on something that Connie
said. I just wanted to pick up on something. Connie talked about the five Californias, and it's odd that about a month ago, one of the rich entrepreneurs out of Silicon Valley put in an initiative in California, which is where people can put in a proposal,
right.
and if they get it, enough signatures, get it on the ballot, so the people make the law. To create six Californias, to cut California into six individual states, his argument giving us more power in the states in the U.S. Senate and
is it a good idea?
I don't think it's a good idea.
Is two Californias, three Californias? Is there a number that you could agree that this state should be divided into, Joe?
I'd divide it into 12. The Tourism Bureau has a pretty good – when you really look at the regions, the weather, the regional economies, it's about 12 different states. I mean, it's the size of a country. I mean, you hear people say this is the eighth or ninth largest economy in the world. But the more interesting figure was that if we were a country, we'd be the 35th most populous on Earth. That's top 20%. We're a country. We're not state size. And I think there is a pretty good argument on the natural for us to be divided into more states.
Mike in Sacramento listening to us up north. Go ahead. You're on the air, Mike.
Yes. Hello.
Go. You're on the air.
Yeah. Yes. always an interesting show.
Thank you.
I would just like to advance. I've been a lifelong Democrat for some time now, no longer, though. And that is because, against my will, I've become aware that what I call the once great party of JFK has kind of devolved into something closer to a kind of an array of criminal organizations that are all out there to benefit their friends and are perfectly willing to destroy families, prosperity, business.
Can you be specific?
Employers.
Can you give us one example of what you're talking about so we can deal with the specific?
Well, just one thing that sticks to my mind, there was a man who, he and his sons had a business that employed 600 people. And it was just viciously driven into the ground, not only by the high taxes, but by relentless visits from state departments of this and that, that destroyed it. It didn't even survive.
They all right, let's, tried we're going to gonna, thank you for your call. I want to get Joel to respond to, again, the business climate. You addressed it a little bit earlier. Is this a good place to do business, this state?
California is considered not business-friendly. Those who rank such things, California is always at the bottom of the rankings because of high taxation and regulation. There was a report that came out this week, we can talk about it later, called L.A., the City in Decline, and it pointed out that small business in Los Angeles got a D ranking from the group that cares about small business. So California is definitely the answer, I think, to a lot of our problems is to have more job creation, and that is more business friendly.
When did this state, Joe, I'm going to let you tackle it. When did this state begin to go south? Because, you know, when I was growing up, California was the state that was on the hill. It had the greatest public education. It had the greatest higher education. The economy was booming. This is where everybody wanted to come, and a third of the nation came here. When did the slide begin, and can you name names or initiatives that perpetuated the decline of this state?
I mean, the state is not declining. The state is growing. It changed.
Not as a place to live, is it?
Let me give you two dates to think about.
Okay.
I think in a trajectory, there was a significant change in the early 1990s with that recession, the end of the Cold War. That changed, particularly in the southern part of the state, a lot of the economy, the underbelly. You know, I'm sitting here in this room talking to you because we had the economic engine of the military-industrial complex that could take my grandmother, an Okie who got D's in high school, you know, into the middle class, trained her so she was ultimately, you know, doing the wiring on space shuttles.
Right.
And, you know, living in a $500,000 house in Anaheim. That transporting mobility engine went away then. The second date I would give you is 1850. This state from its beginnings never had a coherent kind of system of government, still doesn't. It's more and more complicated. One of the real reason why business can't do here is because it's too hard to figure anything out, from permits to regulations to taxes. Mm-hmm. Everything's too convoluted. No one understands it. The people running it don't understand it. And we've gotten away with it for most of our history because so many darn people came here. They were educated other places, so we didn't have to pay for it.
Is part of the problem, Connie, is part of the problem that the state is corrupt, or is part of the problem that the state is not corrupt? That you because corruption sometimes makes things run efficiently.
Yeah, it can if it's not the venal kind of corruption where people are trying to line their own pockets. But I don't think that that's the dichotomy. I think the third thing that put this state on the skids in the wrong place, and with all respect to my dearest friend Joel, is Prop 13. And it's not the part of Prop 13 that protects the mortgages of the little old lady on a fixed income. That I like, and I would fight to keep. But these corporations trade these huge real estate deals with these public buildings, not public buildings, but these huge skyscrapers in downtown LA. They don't pay a single cent of tax on it. We've got to change that because we have defunded the public sector.
You're going to have to give me a chance afterwards.
You're
going to
respond to that. we're going to take a whole hour to talk about that, and also to talk about again the street. Last week on this program, we briefly mentioned the three strikes and you're out movement, which started in California, and it has led to a devastating response in the state. The over incarceration, not only of people in California but around the country. Again, a bad idea that started here and went over throughout the country. We're going to talk about some dramatic reforms that are taking place in the state as it relates to prison reform and over-incarceration. We will do that in the next hour. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Joel Fox, Joel Matthews, and Connie Rice join us live from Culver City tonight. We'll be back after network news and some spots, and we hope you will be back for another full hour of scintillating conversation. tonight from Culver City, California. I'm Bruce Dumont. Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight with commentary by Joel Fox, editor of Fox and Hounds website, Joe Matthews, author and journalist, and Connie Rice, noted civil rights activist and attorney and co-founder of the Advancement Project. We are coming to you from the Westwood One Studios in Culver City, and the phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's at btbdumont. And we're going to be taking calls and continuing our conversation of California, and not just California, but again, looking at broader issues. You know that if you're a regular listener to this program, we've talked about the over-incarceration trend in this country. It is a trend that started in California, the three strikes and you're out movement. It went from here, moved east, and it has led, as it has in so many other states, to overcrowding and over-incarceration, which has created populations that are viewed as illegal by federal courts. The state of California is under a dictate to dramatically change and reform their prisons. And after declining for 6 years, California's prison population is expected to grow by 10,000 inmates in the next 5 years, which will complicate Governor Jerry Brown's efforts to abide by that court order and to reduce overcrowding. And I guess a question I would ask, because, you know, when an initiative passes, it's because the public gets behind it and gets excited about it. The move to reform prisons in California, is it just because of the federal courts dictating change, or is there a change in attitudes, in your view, Connie, and about the wisdom of over-incarcerating people in this state and in this nation, where we have over 2 million people under behind bars?
I know, and I wish it were a change, but I don't see any change. And in fact, if you look at what Governor Brown, this is a Democratic governor, his response to the United States Supreme Court was, "Go fly a kite. We're not doing this." California has been so recalcitrant in its willingness to listen to the courts and its willingness to face what they've done. They've chock-packed full their prisons to the point that two people die every week because they can't get medical care. It's just simply too overcrowded. You have a situation in California where you have conservative Republican justices like Scalia and Kennedy. Kennedy said, California's prison system is crimogenic. I love that word. Crimogenic means it creates crime. I mean, this is from a conservative Republican justice who would no more open the gates of a prison than sell crack cocaine on the corner. So you know it has to be bad for a Supreme Court justice to back the Ninth Circuit, a circuit it hates, in saying to California, get these folks out of your prisons or find some other way to get the numbers down so that you can actually treat these prisoners humanely.
Is there a case to be made, and is there any politician in this state that's making the case that sees the absurdity of over-incarceration and measures it against the fiscal conservatism, at least of many conservatives, Republicans, because the over-incarceration, whether it's in this state or nationally, it's a bad deal.
For fiscally and every other way,
for
too.
Every other – it breaks every law of common sense.
Yep.
I mean, is there a – that would seem to me that there would be political will for that.
I'm deeply reluctant to disagree with Connie on a subject she knows so much more about than me. But, you know, this is a state that recently passed – I have small children and don't get enough sleep, so maybe I'm remembering this wrong. But didn't we pass a change to three strikes?
Yeah.
And we've reduced our prison population by a lot. Now, at the point of the gun, and certainly there's a lot of conversation about doing this, and I think there's deep belief in doing it. But as in so many things in California, our overall governing system is so inflexible that people actually can't do the things that they know they are supposed to do. And that's mm-hmm. not just in prisons. That's in schools. And but where it really hits us is in the two institutions that are truly statewide in the state, the only place where Californians of different regions mingle and meet people, you know, from around the state, and that is the prisons and the universities.
Well, some of the recent changes, because there has been a release of some criminals, right, nonviolent criminals, I guess in the first year or year and a half, it saved the state $1 billion.
There was, to answer your question, Bruce, as you presented it, it partially the reduction is because the governor was forced to do it by the courts. Mm-hmm. But also the voters have taken a more relaxed view. Joe's correct. The three strikes law in California was reformed by a vote of the people. A number of years back, there was a measure that was passed that was that relaxed the incarceration of those who were convicted on drug offenses. Now, how effective that has been open to debate, but the voters did vote in that direction, not to send someone to prison, but to send them to some rehabilitation. Is there any politician, you asked, who is on this bandwagon? The answer is absolutely no. However, I will point out that when Governor Schwarzenegger first came in, he retitled the Corrections Department, Corrections and Rehabilitation Department. He was looking toward trying to rehabilitate and reduce
the prison. Did he put any money to make it happen?
at that time, money disappeared.
There was no money. And when he proposed it, you'd have thought he was proposing selling his firstborn kids. I mean, the reaction was very negative. So, no, there are no politicians who are going to have the courage to champion this. But here's the thing. I think the reason that we're going to finally fix this is because of money. We can't afford this nonsense. You can't afford to put people in prison for life for doing nonviolent drug use that's only theirs. It's just stupid. And we've put away 70% of California's prisoners, and I venture to say a number of other states are the same way, are nonviolent drug users. That makes no sense. We can't afford it anymore.
I think 70% of those that get out are going right back in.
That's because
not only in this state, but in every state.
That's because it's designed to.
Right.
The prison guards and the police unions are under the same umbrella, and to keep their prison union brothers in jobs, you keep sending them back.
Right.
And I think there's, you know, the other big change that we're not talking about, which is there's been an enormous decline in crime and improvements in public safety. I grew up in this town, riding its buses. I mean, it is the two biggest changes in Los Angeles since I was a kid are that it is demonstrably safer in all sorts of ways, and the air is cleaner. I mean, way cleaner. We haven't had a smog alert in this town in almost 10 years.
That's right.
And violent, but because of the recent release of many prisoners, violent crime has gone down. But the early evidence is that property crime and auto theft, I guess, has gone up. But
it's
again, that's still, yeah, from a cost analysis basis, this is something I read in Fox and Hounds this week, and that is that the cost of that is still considerably less than $52,000 per year per prisoner to incarcerate people in the state of California. So if you look at the cost, you know, benefit to it, it still makes sense to find alternative ways and alternatives to prison.
Exactly.
I don't think anybody's arguing that people who break a law shouldn't get punished to some extent. But there's using technology and ankle bracelets. There's more effective way than doing it than $52,000 a year. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. Nice to have you with us this evening. 1-800-723-8029. We'll go to calls in just a moment. But one of the things we've been dealing with and we'll be dealing with as we do these broadcasts from here in California for the next several weeks, as we do when we do the show home base in Chicago. You know, so much of life in this world is depending on perceptions, and perception is reality. And we're dealing with a perception in the city of Chicago where the amount of crime and street crime and gang crime is, and the number of people that are murdered on the streets has become, you know, a black mark against the city of Chicago. And for many years the reputation of race relations and police community relations in Los Angeles was not of a positive nature. I want to get reactions to where it is now, because I want to go back even a long, long time ago, maybe 40, 50 years ago, because when I was a young man growing up and television was new, the image of the Los Angeles Police Department was created by Jack Webb. It was Dragnet. And then it was Adam 12. And these were squeaky, clean officers. And then you had Chips and all of these Hollywood-related television shows created a perception that the police department in Los Angeles was the best, the most pristine in the United States. And then that reputation with Ramparts and some of the other corruption went completely the opposite direction. So, Connie, because this has been such an integral part of your adult life, where would you put the image, the reality and the image of the Los Angeles Police Department right now at this moment in history? Where is it?
Probably somewhere between the Jack Webb and the What's a good police bookend for that?
L.A. Confidential, maybe?
No. We've gotten away from that. It's taken 30 years of my life and another 100 years before that. We've been in a war with our police out here in Los Angeles. And you remember,
when you say we, you mean?
The civic community, the legal community, especially the African-American community, was at war with LAPD. And it was a war that carried over into the streets. And it was on and cracking. And I'm telling you, I when I got to this city, I thought, oh my goodness, this is the only place I'd ever been. And I've been all over this country where I saw such bad relationship between the police and the black community. And yeah, I had to go to Mississippi to find a worse situation. So there was a reason that the Rodney King beating sparked off a riot, and people will remember that. And then 8 years later, we had the Rampart scandal, and that began the end of the old Imperial LAPD. And you got to remember, LAPD was a very well-respected force after the 50s when Chief Parker came in, and
right.
He made them very militarized, and he made them very disciplined, and that's where you got the Jack Webb,
sure.
Just the facts,
that was,
man.
That was right. A spinoff of that.
That's right. And there was some truth to that. I mean, you need to give Chief Parker his due. He professionalized and militarized the LAPD. The downside of that is that it was also racist. There was also a racist undertone to that policing culture. And they had, for example, an official who was supposed to have the South Bureau, Watts, the African-American areas is his area, and he was called the Nigger Inspector. And he was openly called the Nigger Inspector. So you know what I mean? It was open, it was notorious, and there was abject humiliation of the entire black community, and that's why we had that riot when you had the Rodney King beating. After those officers got acquitted of the Rodney King beating.
What was you mentioned Ramparts. I mentioned Ramparts as well. There may be people listening to the broadcast that certainly have heard of that. Give us the thumbnail description of what Ramparts was and how it really tore apart this relationship,
yeah.
Which was already a bad relationship.
That's right. The Rodney King beating was the beginning of the elite, the blue ribbon elite in L.A. saying, okay, LAPD, we're not with you anymore. 8 years later, we had what we call the Rampart scandal, and that was a gangster cop gone amok scandal. You had two officers in particular who were planting evidence on suspects. They shot suspects who shouldn't have been shot. They did everything from steal drugs, plant drugs, lie in court. I mean, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. And go see Training Day. You'll see mm-hmm. Denzel Washington portray the key protagonist there. But the bottom line was that you had a gang unit, a gang suppression unit that went off the rails. And even though Rafael Perez dealt drugs and so forth, that really wasn't the corruption. The corruption was use of force corruption, which has always been LAPD's use of force corruption. And that may be too much in the weeds for most folks, but the bottom line is the federal courts, after the Rampart scandal, that was it. The federal courts stepped in and they took over LAPD, and we got rid of Chief Parks and we put in Chief Bratton, the change agent, the America's change agent cop. And with Bratton, Judge Feist, with a great police commission, people like yours truly and Jerry Chaliff and a number of lawyers who just got in there every day and rolled up our sleeves. I drove my little blue Prius right onto that parking lot in Parker Center to the point where one deputy chief threatened to have it towed because it was a liberal car and they didn't allow liberal cars on a police force parking lot. I mean, this is the old LAPD. So because of Chief Bratton's transformation, LAPD is a different place now.
And what did – Joel, I want to get – because you've spent most of your adult life here. What is your perception of how the Los Angeles Police Department and its relationship with not just the black community but even with the white community, how has that evolved over the last, let's say, 25 years?
Well, that really is a Connie question. But in knowing Connie for many years and following this, there has clearly been a change. Recently, and Connie can tell the story better than I, but I know that the African-American community, which did feel like they were at war with the LAPD, there has been a change of tone there. And they have seen that after Chief Bratton came in and made some changes, that the LAPD has been more of a positive force in that community.
What changes did they make? I mean, was it sensitivity training? What happened?
You had to get rid of the contempt. You had to get rid of the open racism. You had to show respect for everybody. And here's the test. When Brad came in, black community didn't want him. They said no. And 8 years later...
Because he was replacing a black chief.
Yes, yeah. That's right. And 7 years later... When you did looked at the polling, at college-educated African-Americans, Bratton polled higher than any black elected official. That's a huge sea change. He really moved them out there.
But what did he do, Joe?
But it's different people, right? I mean, the cops are actually – it's not the same people. I mean, he hired a lot, and they're better educated. It's a much more diverse force.
Right. It's majority-minority. The force is majority-minority now. There aren't enough women because women do make the best cops, if I don't say so myself. There aren't enough women, but that's growing. And you had the real good guys. You know what we did? We put the good guys in charge of the culture of LAPD. For a long time, the bad cops were in charge. And if you have the culture determined by the bad cops, you're going to get what we had in L.A. Now, the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts of LAPD are in charge, number one. Number two, they really do enforce. There's accountability. There are real investigations when you have police abuse of force investigations. So Bratton came in and said, there's going to be accountability. You're going to treat people with respect, everybody, even if they're poor and black. And we are going to learn how to serve the people of Los Angeles.
And you've been talking about the African-American community. What about the growing Hispanic community?
That's a project in process. All of this is in process. When I say it's changed, I'm talking about the top. I'm not going to tell you that everybody in the back rooms of Devonshire Division has gotten the memo. I'm not going to say that. And people on the street may be listening to me and saying, has she lost her mind? I don't see any difference between the gang, how the gang unit treats my kids. But there is a unit that receives enormous accolades from even poor African Americans and poor Latinos, and it's called the Community Safety Partnership Police, and they're a specialized unit that does community policing, and they are fantastic. They do everything from get bifocals for the 70-year-olds in Watts to making sure the kids have computer tablets. They raise money for the kids. And there's a picture of Captain Tangaridis in the ocean with two black kids under his arms because he realized these kids live in L.A. and no one's ever taken them to the beach. So he got a bus and took all the kids to the beach. I mean, this is the new LAPD. You'd have never had anything like that even 15 years ago.
Joe?
How much, Connie, do you think it is, though, that the city has also changed? I mean, there's no city in America that has been getting older faster than Los Angeles. I mean, we're just older. And, you know, and while we think of ourselves as this very diverse place, you know, and certainly our parents and grandparents from all different places, more of us are from here. We're much more homegrown. Mm-hmm. We're not as likely to be from the other side of the world with different cultural norms. Isn't this just an easier city to police with a demographic profile that is just, you know, it's friendlier to police?
Well, Joy, I think you're onto something there, but I think it's an easier city to police because the police force is so much more like that city. number one. Number two.
But also, the number of police officers per capita, isn't this like one of the smallest ratios ever? I mean, I've been in this. I've been in the city here for about a week now. I think I may have seen three or four police cars.
That's right.
In Chicago, I would have seen 50.
That's right. There are fewer than 10,000 cops for a city this size, and it's the police population ratio is way too. It's out of whack. No, it's not good. It's not good at all, and I've written about this. I think that's part of the genesis of the problems with LAPD is that they had to have a porcupine effect. There weren't enough of them, so they made their presence felt other ways.
Is there any likelihood that that's going to change? That's the question. We'll get reaction when we come back on the other side. 1-800-723-8289. We do have callers standing by in upstate New York and Chicago. We'll bring them into our conversation live from Culver City, California. From coast to coast and border to border since 1980, I'm Bruce Dumont. Every Sunday night on America's Great Talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio, POTUS 124. Boston, Massachusetts to Beverly Hills. You're listening to Be on the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Around the table this evening, we have three great guests from the California, and we're going to begin letting them introduce themselves again. Connie Rice, we'll start with you.
Hi, I'm Connie Rice. I'm a recovering civil rights lawyer, and I do a lot of policy stuff in schools and police and trying to make the city work better for everybody.
And for those around the country, they say Connie Rice. Well, you are related to the other Connie Rice.
She's Condi.
Condi.
Yes. And what's
yes,
the relationship?
She's my cousin. Condi is my cousin.
Are you good friends?
We're friends. Yes, we're good friends.
Good. Joel Fox.
I have a long rap sheet in California politics.
That's right. You've been with Fox News long before it was fashionable.
Yeah, right. I wish I had a piece of it. I've been an advocate for both taxpayers and small businesses. I've consulted on a couple of on a number of measures and policy issues, but also a couple of candidates. Worked with Arnold Schwarzenegger during the recall campaign. I run a website on business and politics in California called foxandhoundsdaily.com, which has been recognized as one of the top political sites in the state. And I do other writing on books and other things. So.
Joel Matthews.
I'm author of a couple books about California and editor and a statewide syndicated columnist through Zocalo Public Square, which is a nonprofit here in L.A. that publishes daily in papers all around the state and the country and puts on free public events around the country. And
what's the goal of the public events? Tell us about those.
To get people to think about big issues and to sort of in L.A. context, civic life, we believe, is still pretty segregated. People do lectures, and the world of ideas is still a pretty older white place, and we're trying to counteract that.
When you were last on this program, you were promoting a book on Arnold Schwarzenegger, the people's machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I asked this question last week of our guests. Was Arnold Schwarzenegger good for California? And specifically last week, did he help or hurt the Republican Party?
Wow. Well, the question of whether he was good for California, as governor, he was a failure, but I thought he was a pretty productive failure for California. He tried a lot of things, tried almost everything, tried Democratic policies, independent policies, Republican policies. None of them worked. Watching him convinced me that essentially the Constitution and the governing system need changing. And it's actually sort of striking that how closely Brown has sort of followed his playbook, though in a different political context, being a Democrat and a different, much more low-key political style. The same policies have had a different effect. The economy has made a difference. So the question of whether he was good or bad for the Republican Party, I'm not sure the Republican Party could be saved, but I think you'd have to say he was good. I mean, he may end up being the last Republican we elect for quite some time.
Well, he didn't change the party, but he did deliver a message. His famous speech, I think it was in Palm Springs, actually.
Indian Wells, where he said
that we're not filling the seats. His movie analogy, he came from the movie world, and he says you're not filling the seats, and he tried to argue the Republican Party has to more match the voters of California to build up. They've now dropped to below 30%. I think he had a great opportunity for change, and I think that was his desire. I actually helped work on his project, which became what was called here California Performance Review, and went by the nickname of blowing up the boxes. He wanted to change the way we did government business in California. There were a lot of good ideas, but he wanted to be liked. And he didn't follow through on that plan.
Last week on this program, the guests, be they Republicans and Democrats, who were saying that Jerry Brown would be tough to beat next time around, they've also described him as, because he has matured, that he has lost the image of Governor Moonbeam. Has he lost that image in your view?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So he's an adult now.
He's an adult.
Let's go to upstate New York. Earl is listening to us. What station are you listening to us on, Earl?
WGBA, Geneva, New York.
Very good. That's way up north.
Oh, yes. We're in the heart. You're in the heart of the Finger Lakes wine country.
Yes. Well, you're probably about as far away from us in Culver City as probably our affiliate base could mention this evening. So what's the view from upstate New York?
Oh, we just got rid of that nasty cold weather here. So, yeah, things are...
Let me ask you a question before you pose the question for our panel. Donald Trump has made it known that he is interested and perhaps ready to run for governor of New York. What would your reaction be if he were the candidate for the Republican Party?
Get a haircut.
Okay. All right, your question that you called for.
If he could be torn away from his, what was the name of that program that he has?
The Apprentice.
Yes.
But you were calling about an issue about minimum wage. You want to know whether it will help, whether it would help or hurt in California. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's let Joel respond to that question.
Well, first of all, there's some issues with minimum wage here in California. The state legislature in the last session increased the minimum wage in California. So we're well above the national level. Since this gentleman's calling from New York, the national minimum wage is about $7.25. We're going to be up to $10 an hour. However, this being California, we may see a ballot measure fight over the minimum wage. There is a Silicon Valley Republican by the name of Ron Unz, who has filed an initiative that would actually raise the minimum wage another $2 to $12 an hour. And that could be a real political battle because the business community opposed the increase to $10. They lost. The governor signed that. I suspect they'll oppose the increase to $12 if Mr. Unz gets his measure on the ballot.
And we end up fighting over the minimum wage stuff because it's a proxy for the real discussion we need to have, which is, how do you create an economic growth system that actually creates enough growth that you don't have to fight over these sub-issues?
Joe, any comment on that?
I mean, I the minimum wage thing to me, it makes me think of our conversation in the earlier hour about the state being so different. There's no California state economy. It's 12 different economies. A lot of them don't have much to do with the other. The notion of having one statewide, I like the idea of minimum wages, I like the idea of higher minimum wages, but having the same minimum wage in the Bay Area as in San Bernardino makes no sense to me.
I want to ask a question that thanks very much for your call, Earl. Appreciate it. This gets back to something we talked about in hour number one, and that's the culture of the state, just the day-to-day interaction of people who live in this state. Is it positive? Is it negative? I mean, what is the people
there
on the street?
There is no interaction.
There's not in much. In fact, there was a great study that more people should read done in 2010 called it was this California Civic Health Index. And they looked at all the different states and compared us, and we scored very low on measures of, do you know your neighbors? Have you worked on community problems? Do you discuss politics or current events at the dinner table? These sorts of things, which tend to be measures of civic engagement, we're very low on. Though I will say we're, particularly compared to most U.S. states, compared to other big diverse states like Texas and Florida and New York, we actually look pretty similar on those measures. They're not all that cohesive as places either.
When I grew up in New England, there were no fences between the neighbors. Here, there are fences between every house.
Fences and swimming pools.
And the issue of illegal immigration, how has that, or has it, torn the state apart politically?
Oh, it has torn the state apart politically. You know, we have the reality of it, and we invited it. And so we accommodated in California in ways that, especially in L.A. County, you know, we look at these folks and it's like, wait a minute, we invited you here to take care of our kids, mow our lawns, do everything in our houses that we want you to do. And what? We expect you to disappear at night? No, you're here. You're here permanently. And you're not going back because we don't want you to go back. So when you look at the part of the economy that undocumented workers are, and you look at the part of our culture that they are, listen, this used to be the northern territories of Mexico. So let's get a grip and come to realism about this problem. This is Calexico, folks. And if you don't want to recognize it, then move to some other part of the country, because the reality, it doesn't make any sense to have a whole bunch of people around you if they're going to be unhealthy and they can't read and write. That's just stupid. The only thing dumber than allowing 12 million people you don't know who they are into your country is to then impoverish them. That's the only thing stupider than what we did in the first place.
And back to a question that when we talked about the population of the prisons, what percentage of the prisons are Hispanic, either illegal immigrants or legal immigrants in this country?
I should know that, but I don't. The majority of the populations in prisons are black and brown. And there is a disproportionate percentage that's undocumented.
I mean, you should be careful not to confuse, as so many people in the rest of the United States do, that Mexican or Hispanic and is illegal immigration. We have lots of undocumented people from all different parts of the world.
Slovakia,
and actually
Russia.
The population is well Asian less countries. The city itself is more Mexican now than the undocumented population. People have been here a long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's not quite the assimilation that's taken place in Texas.
I'm not sure what assimilation is taking place in Texas, but it's a deeply, you know, you're talking about pillars of the community. You're talking about people who have been here longer than native-born Americans.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we come back from Culver City. Bruce Dumont back. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. In case you just tuned in, you missed a little bit of the broadcast, but again, we'll be back next Sunday night at the same time on these same great radio stations. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Let's go to Daniel, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago, the radio home of Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce. You know, I think California's problems have a lot to do. What I've seen is the same as we have in Illinois. Top two on my list would be the amnesty in 86. That would be number two. But number one would be the rise of public unions. And I think both of these not only skew the demographics, but they encourage lawlessness and actually contempt for the law, because the unions end up with a private law, what they call privilege, where they're exempt from antitrust in the first place, and then you tack on, you know, exemptions from Obamacare and bailouts from the auto sector.
One aspect of what you say seems to make some sense, at least as it relates to a discussion that we had, and I think Connie alluded to it a couple of segments ago, and that is some of the pressure to lead to the over-incarceration, not only in California but around the country. It is the public. It is the guards unions, the correction officers, and the police office, they want more business.
Well,
they want more prisons built so they get more jobs and they get more union membership. And, you know, even what's happened in Arizona, the crackdown on illegal immigration in Arizona, a lot of the money came from AFSCME.
The caller has put his finger on a problem here because the unions are very powerful politically. They obviously take money automatically from their members, and they have a kitty to get involved in a lot of political endeavors. And a comparison with Illinois and California is the debates over pensions and the public employee
right.
pensions, and how that's squeezing the budgets for other purposes. In Los Angeles, they're projecting in a few years that 23% of the budget's going to go to these pension and health care costs for public employees, and that squeezes money so we can't hire the more than 10,000 police that we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's coming to a head out here. The governor made a small change last year, not really significant. There may be a ballot initiative, may not, that's being pushed by a Democratic mayor of San Jose. So that issue is very much akin to what's going on. I know Chicago talked about raising property taxes
right.
to cover some of the pension obligations there. And so that issue that the caller talked about in Illinois does play here in California.
But I disagree with the union bashing. My family wouldn't have made it without unions. My grandfather wasn't allowed to go to school in South Carolina, and he was a member of the Steelworkers Union. He signed his paycheck with an X. Without that union, my grandfather would never have been able to send his kids to college. And so this automatic sort of Pavlovian kill the unions has got to stop. What I would love is a productive conversation about how we fund our public sector, how we fund the pensions in a way that's affordable without destroying the public sector, and how to make sure that unions can grow legitimately. And that's a conversation worth having.
But when, it's not killing the unions, Connie. It's political reality and what has evolved over the time with the political power that they've brought to themselves and how they're affecting.
I don't understand why we have to dump on unions when it comes to Wall Street. We don't talk about anybody needing to be cut back and curtailed, and they're the robber barons here.
I'm anti-union, but again, I think you have to put certain things in context. I mean, when you look at the if a business person did it, it would be a conflict of interest. You are a member of a union that is supporting a public policy that is building more prisons to create more jobs for your people.
That's right.
Now, that's something that stinks about.
And public policy has to counter that. When the unions are asking for stuff they shouldn't be asking for, that's the role of public policy to say no to the union.
But there's no way in our system to do it. California is so peculiar. It has these very powerful public employees. Joel is right about that. But the problem is that Joel and other people who gave us Prop 13 and this heavily centralized system are a big part of the reason why we have such powerful public employees. With Prop 13, we took away the ability of local officials to tax, and that has created deep centralization in Sacramento, which has been good for the unions. It's also taken away the taxpayer interest at the local level that was a check on the unions. But anti-tax insurers in the state, you know, don't want to hear it. They don't want to realize it. And because they hated taxes more, they've been willing to tolerate centralization and powerful public employee unions. And it's crocodile tears we've heard for 20 years about it.
I got to defend Prop 13. It's been attacked twice here now. It didn't take away the power to tax. It made it more difficult to tax. Property taxes have risen as the most stable and fastest growing tax in the state. And as far as what Connie said earlier, taxing businesses, you're going to hurt small businesses. They always talk about corporations, but
no,
small businesses
are
we have less than a minute left. I want to ask, I'm going to start with you, Joe. Is there anything that's been said on this program that has been misconstrued, or is there any misconception about this state that has taken place over the last 2 years, 2 hours in this broadcast?
I think the
short
big,
answer.
The big misconception is this is a homegrown state. It's much more. It's much less diverse, and it's becoming less dynamic in a host of ways. And that's our biggest problem.
That was Joe Matthews, Connie Rice.
No, I don't think there's a misperception. We probably didn't talk about all of the aspects of California. California is a complex, wonderful place. But
you
it's
mean we
got
can't solve these problems
in
2 hours?
No.
Joel Fox.
You know, California has some problems, but it has always managed to rebound. I think it will rebound again, but we do have to deal with some of the structural problems.
Yeah. Joel Fox, Connie Rice, Joe Matthews, thank you all for being with us on this week's edition of Beyond the Beltway. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz back in Chicago for helping make the program possible, as well as Corey Irwin and Ted Woods here in Culver City, and also a big thank you to Dave Felker as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Until next week at this same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from California.